Our Lord often preached about being good stewards of God's gifts. A legal will guarantees that the important people in your life and everything you've worked for will be taken care of according to your wishes and our Catholic faith. Make your will today using free will. Go to relevantradio.com/freewill to learn more. That's relevantradio.com/freewill. It's absolutely free.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, happy Monday morning to you. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Hope you enjoyed your weekend break. I sure did. And I want to acknowledge countless, and by countless, I mean thousands of you have expressed how enthusiastic you are about the shows in which I read your emails. Because literally thousands of you are sending me emails. I get them on a daily basis. Sometimes I get dozens and dozens in any given day. And so to respond to your overwhelming desire for me to read more emails, that's what I'm going to do. And probably most of the show today will be devoted to that. And I love hearing from you. I appreciate the time you take to send me your emails. So let's get started. The first email that I'll read right now comes in from Jonathan, listening in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He says, I'm a public health officer in the military and currently deployed. Part of my public health mission is to prevent, educate troops on, and report on sexually transmitted diseases among troops. Normally, I can skirt around distributing condoms because I have enlisted members who do that in my stateside unit. However, while deployed, it is expected that I stock the men's bathrooms with condoms. Am I complicit in these troops' mortal sins by providing them with condoms? I'm struggling with whether to provide the condoms at all, and I don't think I would get into trouble if I don't provide them. As a faithful Catholic, I do not want to lead others into mortal sin, but wasn't sure where the moral line for me is drawn, as it is part of my job here. We do tell the troops that the best way to avoid an STD is abstinence. Any help you can provide would be greatly appreciated. Wow. This is one of those real-world situations that many people find themselves in. So thank you for your confidence, and I'll be happy to share with you what I believe is the correct answer to this question, Jonathan. And that is, first of all, as a general moral principle, that you can never do something evil as a means to a good goal. And an analogy that comes to my mind every time this comes up would be, it's a really good goal, for example, to feed hungry people, people on the street, etc. But in order to feed them, you can't, for example, rob a bank and steal the money from the bank in order to use the money to feed the poor people. That's a good goal, and we should try whatever illicit means we can to do that. But we can't rob a bank or kill somebody for his money in order to feed the poor people. So that's kind of an exaggerated, you know, probably a very unrealistic likelihood that something like that would happen. Although, yes, I'm familiar with Robin Hood, and that's essentially what he did. But there's an example of where you can't do something evil to try to achieve a good goal. I would say that the same thing is true here. The good goal is you don't want the troops to catch an STD. Now, this is a family show, so I won't go into any detail. Parents, just be aware if this is a topic that's not appropriate for younger children who are there with you, then, you know, act accordingly if necessary. Turn the radio down for a minute or two. But the main thing is, it is a good goal to try to help people avoid getting an STD. And it's a really good thing to say what you have said, and that is the best way to do it is to tell them, don't do the things that are likely to lead you into a situation where you're going to get an STD. That's the right answer. So what about distributing condoms? Well, the Catholic Church teaches that artificial contraception is a serious sin, and it can take different forms. So this particular form is a barrier form. There's also a chemical form. There's also the form of surgical procedures that can sterilize somebody. And there are other methodologies that I will leave unsaid, but there are other ways in which procreation can be avoided. And the Church says that any intentional effort to do that is a serious sin. Now, obviously, people who are fornicating are committing another sin, and this simply compounds that sin If we're talking about marital intimacy, it is a different scenario, different circumstances, obviously, but it's still sinful. So you want to avoid directly as much as possible any kind of participation in a serious sin, but definitely avoid any kind of direct participation in a serious sin. And in this case, you would be directly participating, even though you're being compelled to do so because these are your orders. I've never been in the military, so I don't know to what extent this is the kind of issue that would fall under a conscientious objection. I don't know if that would even apply under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I would have to consult with people who are in the military or people who were in the military. But my guess is that if, as you alluded to in your email, if you could tell your commanding officer, I have personal moral qualms about doing this because as a Catholic, I believe my church is teaching that this is something sinful, and I don't want to be in a position where I have to distribute these condoms. Could you please find somebody else to do that? So if I'm reading your email accurately, it sounds to me as though you may well be able to do that. That's what I would do. The only other thing it seems that you could do would be if somebody said, nope, sorry, you got to do this. I don't know what circumstances I don't know if you're an officer. You're a public health officer, so I'm assuming then you're an officer. Some men and women, I guess, they get to the point where they're being asked to do something that's immoral, can take the drastic step of resigning their commission. Now, hopefully this is not at that level in terms of what you would have to do to avoid this. But if I were you, I would try every reasonable, practical, certainly lawful way to exempt yourself from doing this. And if that's successful, great. If it's not successful, then ultimately, I suppose the nuclear option, if we could call it that, would be to resign your commission. You know, thanks for the email. As I'm thinking about this, I'm also reminded of some of these terrible stories that we heard coming out of Vietnam, for example, and not just there, but other, you know, practically any given war will have any number of stories like this, but where soldiers are commanded to do something that would be immoral. And like, say, for example, to execute prisoners of war. If they've surrendered and they're no longer enemy combatants, they no longer pose a threat to you, it would be immoral. It would be the sin of murder to intentionally kill, prisoners of war. And so if you were a soldier and your commanding officer ordered you to, you know, take those 10 guys who are prisoners, line them up and shoot them, you would have an obligation to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Well, you're going to be court-martialed if you don't do it. Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do that because it is contrary to God's law. And sometimes the price that one has to pay for standing firm and doing the right thing can be extreme. But that's what martyrs are made out of. I'm not suggesting that you're going to be a martyr because you're not going to pass out condoms to the soldiers. But up to that very extreme level of somebody saying, I can't go for that. I'm not going to do that. That would violate God's law. And I have to say no. And if the penalty involves some tremendous suffering or even death itself, that's what martyrs are made out of. So let's hope and pray it doesn't come to that. Thanks for the email. This email comes in from Joe, listening in Philadelphia. He says, I have been binge-watching atheist debates. And he names a specific atheist. He says, he doesn't have a degree in philosophy, but he is self-taught. He seems intelligent and well-read in philosophy to support his belief system. But I noticed a common thread in debates, and I wanted your opinion. He doesn't believe in the supernatural and demands solid proof in the natural. I think what you mean by this, Joe, is that he doesn't believe in the supernatural realm, spiritual things, for example, but he demands proof from science, something in the realm of science. I think that's what you mean by natural. This seems like a one-sided approach since the triune God and all heavenly beings operate in the supernatural. This particular atheist debater is not open to God with obstinate arms crossed and will never encounter God. God doesn't owe him anything. Jesus said, knock and the door shall be opened. Seek and you shall find. Genuine faith, absence of objective proof, is the conduit to the supernatural. And so he's giving a quote from this gentleman. Jesus said, the more you have, the more given, and the less you have, the more will be taken away. What are your thoughts? Well, I've got a few thoughts. The first thing is, you're right. Your instinct is correct to say that to demand scientific proof for the existence of God is like hitting the bullseye on the wrong target. Because God, by very definition, at least if we're talking about God as we know God, obviously there are different understandings of God, different ways of thinking about God, that are not correct, but I'm going to assert, without making the effort to prove, but I will assert that the God of the universe, the God that the Catholic Church acknowledges, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the faith of our fathers, that God, he is outside of time and space, which means that he's outside of the realm of science. Science deals with pre-given physical realities. And science and the scientific method is based upon observation. And observation is based upon what our senses can tell us about the external world, things that we can see or touch or hear or taste, etc. Now, you can't touch a radio wave, but we have, through our senses, we have instrumentation, we have methodologies that allow us to observe and therefore quantify and study and come to an understanding of these physical phenomena. But God, by his very nature, is outside of all that. So an analogy that has come to my mind more than once is, it would be similar to demanding that you demonstrate the chemical composition of the dirt on Mars by using the rules of Spanish grammar. What? What do you mean, the rules of Spanish grammar? They have nothing to do with the chemical composition of the soil on Mars. How on earth could a Spanish textbook tell you anything about the composition of the soil on Mars? It can't, obviously, because they're two separate categories of reality, and the one has nothing to do with the other. And so in a way similar to that, science is simply incapable of demonstrating the existence, or for that matter, the non-existence of God. That's something very important to recognize. Now, if it's possible to see in scientific discoveries things that point to the existence of God, great, we can go in that direction. A good example of that that comes to mind would be DNA. And DNA, keep in mind, is information. It is information. It's instructions that are coded into our genes, coded into the DNA itself, in which your body, each individual gene, has information and in instructions to tell the body what to do with this particular cell. Now, instructions, information, it clearly presupposes that there's a mind behind it. Because random words, you know, if you have an infinite number of chimpanzees typing for an infinite amount of time on typewriters, are never going to come up with War and Peace. It's not even a probability issue. It would never happen. Because random, chaotic, blind forces working upon each other randomly in an undirected manner, doesn't matter how much time goes by, you're not going to come up with War and Peace. So as in our modern science is unfolding and becoming more and more powerful and more insightful, we're realizing that our very DNA, and not just us as humans, but, you know, creatures in general, our DNA is a set of coded instructions that are intelligible and readable and executable like a software program, but far more complicated than a software program. So nobody in his right mind would say, well, you know, Microsoft Office or some Apple software program that you really like, it's just a matter of happenstance. It just happens to be there. It's, you know, eons of time in which blind, undirected forces working randomly against each other in an undirected manner over a long period of time came up with Microsoft Office. Obviously impossible. Ludicrous. Nobody would accept that, because on the face of it, you can see that this byproduct, this program, in order for it to be instructions and information and executable, it has to have a mind behind it in order to bring that into existence. So there's an example of where science, looking at the cosmos and looking at evidence and trying to make sense out of it runs into certain things that point to, I would argue, the existence of God. Otherwise, how else do you account for that? Random chaos cannot result in intelligible, readable, executable instructions that are so minutely detailed. It can't happen. So all this to say that in your evaluation of these questions that you're asking me about this particular atheist and others like him would be to just say at the outset, and obviously you're not talking directly to this atheist, but if you ever meet an atheist, just say, well, if you're demanding scientific proof for the existence of God, you're going to be waiting a long time. We can furnish examples of things in science that point to the existence of God. They don't prove the existence of God, but they go a long way towards showing the reasonableness of believing in God. But in the same way that you can't use science to prove love, you can't use science to prove God. You can't use science. How would you use the scientific method to prove that some action is either moral or immoral? Obviously impossible. Doesn't matter how fine-tuned or how sophisticated and powerful the scientific instrument might be. How are you going to use a microscope to determine whether or not stealing is moral or immoral? You can't, because it's beyond the limits of science. It's beyond the province of science. So for that reason, don't be buffalo, don't be cowed, don't be intimidated. If you run into an atheist who demands scientific proof for the existence of God, you should just educate him and help him understand that he's demanding the impossible. Not that it's impossible to demonstrate the reasonableness of believing in God, but it's impossible to use science as the final arbiter of whether or not God does or does not exist, in the same way that it would be ludicrous to try to use the rules of Spanish grammar to determine the chemical content of the dirt on Mars. You see what I'm saying? I think it's self-evident once you see it. It's like, well, Cyrus, you've seen those pictures. You know, it looks just like a jumble of dots. Remember that? Maybe you saw one of these in school. I think I saw the first one when I was in like seventh or eighth grade. And the teacher showed us this picture, and it was just a whole bunch of random dots. And there were dots of different sizes. And you stare at it, and you stare at it, and you stare at it, and you're saying, what am I staring at? It doesn't look like anything. It's just a bunch of dots. And then if you stare at it long enough, suddenly it comes into focus. Your mind recognizes that that's a face. And it was intended to be there all along. It was there all along. But at first, it just looked random and unintelligible. You've seen those, haven't you?
Yeah, they're like terribly frustrating. And I'd stare at it for 30 minutes.
Yeah. They used to call them, or at least back in the 80s, it seems to me, there was this thing called the magic eye, where there would be posters.
That's it. Yeah, the magic eye.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then at first glance, it's just
infuriating.
It looks like, right. And then there are some people who just can't see it.
Yeah, and then these other people walk up, and they see it immediately.
Right.
Like, it's nothing to them. And I was the guy that would stare at it for half an hour and be like, this is a prank. I'm being pranked. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
And then it would come into focus, and I'm like, it's real.
Yeah,
it's really there. Whoa.
And it was there all along, and it was right in front of you, but you couldn't see it. But once you saw it, you probably couldn't not see it, right?
Well, yeah, for a minute, until I came back the next day, and then I'd have to train my eyes to focus.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's sort of the summary. I'm glad that you saw these things also, Cyrus, but it's kind of the summary of my response here, that sometimes the truth is right there in front of your eyes and you just don't see it. And that's okay, because sometimes it's not your fault. But if you look at it long enough, it will appear. And that's what I'm arguing for in this case, is that for some who say, well, I don't see any evidence for God, well, if you're trying to use science to prove it one way or the other, that he exists or that he doesn't exist, you're never going to be satisfied, because science can't do that. Thank you, Cyrus. I know we're getting close to a break, but do I have time to squeeze one more email in?
Let's do one more.
Okay. This one comes in from Iris. She's listening on the Relevant Radio app. She says, your mention of Fleetwood Mac on an earlier show made me think. And by the way, I love that. Whenever something that happens on the program makes you think, that's the best possible outcome. She says, I used to love that band, Fleetwood Mac, and I had the opportunity to see Stevie Nicks at Jazz Fest one May. My siblings had free tickets that sat unused, and it caused some friction. I just can't enjoy their music ever since Stevie Nicks said that she that if she hadn't had an abortion, there would be no Fleetwood Mac. I remember when that came out, Iris. In fact, we did a segment on that on the program, probably about an hour's worth talking about that. People had a lot of strong opinions. So Iris says, since she said that if she hadn't had an abortion, there would be no Fleetwood Mac, as much as I love their music, I just can't justify sacrificing a life for it. And it's extremely narcissistic of her to think that way. I change the radio station and skip their songs anytime her music comes on. My husband agrees with my decision regarding the concert and is not looking up their music anymore, but he thinks it's overkill to switch the station every time. Is there such a thing as overkill in this situation? I understand where you're coming from on this, Iris, and I can understand the qualm that you feel, because I'm guessing that you, yes, you are disgusted, you are, you know, deeply disappointed the fact that she would say what she did say, which is, you know, isn't it great that I had this abortion? Because if I had kept this baby, all of the happiness that you would have gotten from listening to Fleetwood Mac music wouldn't have happened, because there would have been no Fleetwood Mac. I doubt that premise, by the way. But in any case, it is a disgusting and selfish attitude, no doubt about it. But I see your husband's point for this reason, that you're listening to the music, and maybe this is the essence of your qualm. It may be that you feel as though by listening to and enjoying their music, somehow that translates into your approving of or condoning, or maybe at the very least just sort of overlooking the fact that Stevie Nicks had chosen an abortion so that she could continue her career. And I would propose to you respectfully that it doesn't translate that way. It doesn't mean, and God isn't looking at you when you're tapping your foot as you listen to one of their songs. God is not frowning at you and saying, oh, so you approve, do you? That's not how it works.
I took a break from her music when that news came out, and I stopped playing Stand Back and all the other Fleetwood Mac stuff that we have on tap. And I did the same thing with U2 when they came out for a very pro-abortion stance in, was it Ireland, wherever they're from? And that was it. So but it was easier for me to not listen to their music anymore. Where Fleetwood Mac, I still turn it up when it comes on the radio.
Yeah, and this is a judgment call. And I hear what you're saying, Cyrus. I would put it this way. It's easy for me not to listen to U2 just because I don't like those guys. I have a sort of a proactive dislike for them. And therefore, not listening to their music doesn't bother me a bit. And I realize that I am greatly in the minority. I have a feeling you're with me in the minority on this.
I am. Yeah, we were on the same page on this one. It was very easy for me to, it was like I was looking for an excuse to turn the channel.
And I know that we're in the minority because they're so popular with so many people. And I've had conversations with people who just, they cannot fathom. What do you mean you don't like U2? It's like, what do you mean you don't like the Beatles? That's my reaction when somebody says they don't like the Beatles. I think you're just being difficult. How can you not like the Beatles? But yeah, I'm one of those people when it comes to U2. I just do not like them. And I will turn the radio off, or I'll turn, you know, the music off if a U2 song comes on. So in other words, what I'm saying, Iris, is I get it. And Cyrus, I get what you're saying here too. And that's why I think when I say a judgment call, what it means is that if it irks you, and it certainly does, and there's a good reason for it, then yeah, I think it's a good idea to turn it off. But if, and maybe this is what your husband is referring to, if it, you're doing it because you think that God thinks that you are somehow condoning this by enjoying the music, then I would say, yeah, that could be in the territory of overkill. That could be in the territory of, you know, avoiding something for the wrong reason. You can avoid it for the right reason. But I think if that's the concern, then I don't think it is necessary that you avoid it. Now, just to put a little fine point on this, because I know we have to take a break. If this is in some way, let's say, directly contributing to this. So let's say that Stevie Nicks came out with this interview, as she did, and said what she said, and then you went out and bought her album, knowing that this is the case, and in essence kind of rewarding her for such a bad decision, then yeah. I mean, if somebody is supporting them and their music, knowing that this is maybe a validation of what the person did, I can see where that could go into an area that you wouldn't want to go to. But it doesn't sound like that in this case. And you can still appreciate the art with, at the same time, being firm in your rejection of what the artist has done. I think I go back to the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were paragons of the hippie culture, the drugs, you know, the free love, and who knows whatever else they may have been into that I don't necessarily even need or want to know. But I can enjoy the beauty of Let It Be without thinking about the personal lives of the men who played the instruments and sang on that album. I can really appreciate it for what it is, and that doesn't endorse maybe some of the bad things they were doing in their personal lives. I think that explains it. Anything you want to add, Cyrus? Because I know you and I are on the same page on this issue.
Yeah, I like that. I like looking at art. Art, when something is created, it's for the interpreter to decide what it is and what it means, not the artist. The artist doesn't get to tell me what that art
what you
means
have to think.
Me. That's right. And so that's how I look at all that.
Well, you obviously listen to the Patrick Madrid Show, don't you?
I've learned a thing. I have learned a thing or two.
Well, we're all in this together. We're all learning together. Okay, I think it's time to take a break. We'll do that, and I'll be right back with more of your emails. Once again, we've had such an overwhelming support for my reading emails into the thousands of people expressing themselves. I want to do fair justice to that. So we'll be back with more of your emails right after this. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity Healthshare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, welcome back, and thanks again for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. If you want to send me an email, just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. This email comes in from Valerie, listening in Los Angeles. She's listening to our blowtorch station there, 93KHJ. Cyrus, used to listen to KHJ when I was a young feller in Southern California where I grew up. And all kinds of great classic rock was playing on that. Never occurred to me in a million years that one day I would be 3 hours a day on that big blowtorch station. But here I am. Look at me. 93KHJ. All right, so this comes in from Valerie, as aforementioned. I have bipolar 1 with psychotic features, PMDD and PCOS. I am currently taking psychiatric medicine. I have therapy and am doing self-care and exercising. I still get really depressed around the time I have my period, and I have heavy irregular periods. I want to be more mentally stable in relationships and at work. For these reasons, do you recommend that an IUD would be a good idea for me? I'm not sure what to do because I'm concerned if I'll be able to get pregnant later. And I can't help but wonder if using an IUD to treat depression is against God's will for us. Very important question, Valerie. So let me begin by reminding everybody, I am not a doctor. I can't give medical advice. I wouldn't know what medical advice to give because I'm not a doctor. I'm not trained in that. But I can speak to the issue of morality of certain actions, this being one of them. So let's talk a little bit about that. I don't know if having an IUD put in is even a treatment or a therapy that is prescribed for what you have, for the bipolar 1 condition that you're experiencing. I don't know. And it actually kind of surprises me because, after all, this is a gynecological measure, and it has one intended purpose, at least the only one that I'm aware of, is to make the uterine lining inhospitable for implantation. That's the whole point of it. So it's not a chemical, obviously, at least the form that I'm aware of. It's a plastic or metal, perhaps, and it's intended to striate, if that's the right word for it, the uterine lining, so that a conceived unborn child at that stage, that early stage, cannot implant. And if the pregnancy cannot implant, it can't continue. And it would therefore be lost. So I'm just surprised to hear that an IUD would even be recommended, because I don't get the connection. I don't see how that's connected with the issue of the psychiatric condition that you're dealing with. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that it is. Just because it might be, but I've never heard of such a thing, but let's assume that it is. What do you do? Well, this is really going to get down to a question that you didn't tell me the answer to in your email, and I have no business to know unless you wanted to tell me, but you didn't tell me, so I'm just going to put it out there, and you'll have to answer this for yourself. If you are married, and I'll use that as the primary example, and you're living with your husband as married people live, and you're doing the things that married people tend to do, well, I certainly would not. If I were you, I absolutely would not have an IUD, because even though the intended purpose for it is to help with your health, it would have a direct abortifacient effect on the possibility if you had a baby conceived, that baby would die. Now, this doesn't really fit into the category of the principle of double effect. And I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but what it means essentially is that you can do something that is legitimately good, like get chemotherapy to cure cancer or radiation, for example. You can pursue that line of therapy to save yourself from cancer, even if you are pregnant and you know that getting the chemo or getting the radiation would inevitably result in the death of the child. Or, to use another example, if you had an ectopic pregnancy. And there's no way that this little tiny conceived child who is a very early stage of development could ever survive outside the womb. But unless you have the fallopian tube removed, you yourself would die. What the church says under those kinds of conditions is that there's a double effect. In other words, you're not doing something that's intrinsically evil by having a fallopian tube removed. You're not doing anything that's intrinsically evil by having chemotherapy or radiation. Even though you know that the resulting effect is going to be the unintended death of the unborn child, the church says under circumstances like those, you would not be doing anything immoral. Now, there is a kind of crossover here, because if indeed it turns out that there is a legitimate prescribed reason for having an IUD, although I have a hard time imagining what that might be. But let's just say, and I could just picture, Cyrus, there are going to be zillions of emails coming in. Yes, 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 this is what is how it's treated. I don't know. We'll find out. But the problem here is that if you're married and if you're sexually active, even outside of marriage, what happens is you would knowingly be in a position where this unborn child would die. So this is where it becomes difficult. And if you know that you would be intentionally putting not just at risk, but it would definitely have the abortifacient effect. If the IUD is fitted properly, etc., it's going to do that. It's going to kill this unborn child. I don't see how in good conscience you could do that, especially if there's an alternative. You mentioned medicines in your email. So my advice would be avoid it at all costs. Just avoid it and just say to the doctor, that's one therapy I'm not interested in pursuing. What else have you got? What are my options? And he may say, well, we've got the medicine, or we've got this, or we've got that, or we've got the other. Okay, because in those cases, all other things being equal, if you take those courses of action, it's not putting someone else's life in jeopardy. So that would be my suggestion. It is better to do what you can to avoid that situation. And I think that's probably about all I can tell you on that. There is a book, though, if you're interested. It's called Life Issues, Medical Choices by Dr. Janet Smith and Dr. Chris Kazor. And it's readily available online, or you can get it at your local Catholic bookstore. And I would recommend getting that, because in addition to all the different examples that are regularly happening in the lives of people, especially in healthcare and medicine, moral dilemmas and quandaries that they face. This, of course, doesn't mean that you're in the healthcare profession, but you're being advised by people who are. The book is helpful because not only does it help you get to the solution of what would be the right thing to do in a given situation, but also it lays out the principles of Catholic morality so that you have the tools to evaluate and look at a given choice and say, if I do this, is this the right thing to do? Is it the wrong thing to do? Is there a better way that I could achieve this goal? So that would be a great book that will help you. Again, it's called Life Issues, Medical Choices by Dr. Chris Kazor and also Dr. Janet Smith. This one comes in from Beth, listening in Salt Lake City. Thank you for this, Beth, listening on 1010 AM. I'm a new listener to Relevant Radio over the past few months. I just went through RCIA and had my first communion in the Catholic Church at the Easter Vigil of this year. I've never been happier with a decision in my life, and I have learned so much, but I'm still trying to learn all that I can about the Catholic faith. The question I have and am struggling with is, can I be frustrated, annoyed, and not even want to be around people and still be a good person and a follower of Jesus? I am learning it is not my place to judge anyone, and I keep hearing love the sinner but not the sin. But is it me just not liking someone's personality? Is that not liking someone's personality a sin? Or if I know someone is doing wrong, is it okay to not like the person or their behavior? Or is that too much judgment on my part? Or if they don't believe in God and act certain ways that are not right with God necessarily, can I not like someone? Or is this a sin on my part? I'm also a nurse practitioner and do clinical-based work, nothing emergent or life-threatening at the moment, but in my past, I was an ICU nurse. I find myself losing motivation to help people because the troublesome patients take all your time and are often not happy no matter what you do. And I find myself not caring and not wanting to help, but to push back when being questioned about anything because I feel I work very hard and then someone is upset and it consumes my every thought. I'm struggling to know if I am still a good Catholic and not a sinner in God's eyes if I don't like some people and I don't want to interact with them. This can be family or friends, and I do have family members I don't want to be with. And to be honest, it is the ones that don't believe in God and who have different views on life. I want to have a job in life with purpose, and I'm struggling to know if the way I am feeling means I should be doing things differently. I'm hoping to hear your advice, and I'm so happy I found Relevant Radio, and I love your show. Thank you. Well, thanks for all of the above, Beth. Let's posit, first of all, in the time that I have, that it sounds to me like part of what you're dealing with here is emotion. And emotion, St. Thomas refers to that as passion. It's not just like sexual passion, but some force that works on you that is not your own free choice. Like hunger, that's a passion. You don't have the choice to be hungry or not hungry. You just are hungry. Your body is acting on you and your mind by telling you, hey, I'm hungry, feed me. Sexual passion, our emotions, feeling depressed. I mean, there's so many ways in which this happens. And the thing to remember here is that you're not accountable for that. You're not accountable, just like you're not accountable for temptations. Temptations are not sins. It's what you do with them. That's where you either cross the line into sin or you don't. When your will is engaged and you make a decision to cooperate or not cooperate. So in this case, I think first thing to remember is you're dealing with, it, to some extent at least, you're dealing with your emotions. Certain people you just don't like, and that's the way it is. Walter Cronkite, and that's the way it is. And that's the way it is. It just is that way. I mean, in life, there are some people you just don't like, and it's sometimes mysterious to know why. Why do I not like this person? And in my life, that's happened, and I sometimes just have to scratch my head and say, I really don't know why, but objectively speaking, or maybe subjectively speaking, I really just don't like this person. And I know other people look at me that way. I just don't like him. I just don't want to be around him. I don't want to talk to him. So no, it's not a sin because you're experiencing a kind of natural human attraction to some people and a repellence from other people. It's just the way God made us, and you can't help that. Now, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't strive to be charitable even to people you don't like. Jesus said that. You know, love your enemy. Do good to those who persecute you. Bless those who curse you. He said all those things. And he says, you know, if you're just being nice and doing good things for the people that you love, for like your family or your friends, so what? That's nothing meritorious. But when you do that for people that you don't necessarily like emotionally or that you don't necessarily get along with and you're going the extra mile to be good to them, then you're laying up treasure in heaven, as Jesus says. So I would use that as the guide here that although maybe you don't want to be around certain people, if you find that you don't have any choice and you have to be around them, to make the best of it and be gracious about it and offer it up to God. Lord, you know, I don't like to be in this situation. I don't want to be around this person. But because I have to be, I'm going to be gracious and I'm going to offer this up to you for my own purification. I would try that. Give that a try. And I have a feeling you're going to look back later and say, you know, that really helped me to become more patient, or it helped me to become more empathetic. And one last thing is, yes, I mean, in answer to your question, you are a good Catholic if you are trying to do the right thing. That's the essence. That's the essence of being a good Catholic. Do you love the Lord and are you seeking to do what he's asking of you? And even the difficult things, remember Jesus said, if you wish to be my follower, pick up your cross and follow me. He also said, if you want to be my follower, deny yourself. And this may be a really good example of what he had in mind. You know, it would be easier to just not be around some really irritating people. But if that's not possible, you make the best of it and you offer it to the Lord and you try to be gracious as best you can. And if there are some people that are just impossible to be around, then don't be around them. And you're not doing anything wrong by that. You know your limitations. And you know, Lord, if I'm around this person, I'm going to get angry and I don't want to sin or I don't want to become judgmental. So the best way to handle it is I'll just put some distance between me and that person. And if I never see that person again, so much the better. But if I happen to see that person again, I'm going to try very hard to be gracious. And I don't have to be palsy-walsy, but I'm going to try very hard, Lord, to be charitable. I think that is the essence of being a good Catholic in this area. Anyway, thank you for that. I know we have to take a break. We'll do that right now, and we'll come right back to your emails. I'm doing a big email day today on the Patrick Madrid Show. And who knows, I might just read yours right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You see how quickly the hour goes by. Welcome back. Here's an email that comes in from Kathleen listening in Monterey. She says, our son is dating a non-Christian Jewish woman. What advice can you give us? My husband and I have followed and practiced our faith as a priority without fail. Our Catholic faith has always been a priority as we've raised our children as well. Our son, and he's in his 20s. I don't want to give away too many personal details just for the sake of people's privacy. Our son in his 20s, and this would be mid-20s, started dating a Jewish woman and didn't tell us for 8 months, nor did he let his friends know. Another 6 months passed, and although she has been introduced and socializes with his friends, he is still not interested in introducing us to her. He had many opportunities to do so while we were living in the same area. Unfortunately, my husband's job has now relocated us at some distance. Our son recently told us that he was taking his girlfriend on a trip to Mexico. I expressed my feelings about waiting to go on such trips until he was married, and he told me I was narrow-minded and I was living in the dark ages. Ah, what wisdom a mid-20s young man has. He said that I was narrow-minded and living in the dark ages. He also told me not to plan on visiting him the next time we were in town. During COVID, when he met this woman online, he was not practicing his faith. Prior to COVID, he was. I asked him several months ago to please return to the practice of his faith. He said he would and tells me today that he is. I feel I must trust his word and not question his faith practice, otherwise I'll push him further away. I've expressed the value of a Christ-centered marriage and how our spouse should help us get to heaven, but he tells me that is not the most important thing. He says being happy is more important. He told me that I want him to be lonely and unhappy. So she says, I thought maybe you could offer us some faithful advice. I'll do my best. Thank you, Kathleen, and my heart goes out to you and your husband because I can imagine the anguish that it causes you, because you just want your son's happiness, not only in this life, but also in the life to come. And so you're expressing the truth to him, and I'm sure it hurts your heart because he's not saying, you know what, Mom, you're right. But really what you're asking him to do is what Jesus himself said, which is put first the kingdom of God and everything else will be added unto you. It's a simple formula. It's not easy, but it is simple. And that's what he's being faced with. Now, there are several problems here, it sounds like, based upon your email. One of them is he's, as the Bible talks about, St. Paul talks about this, being unequally yoked. Now, in context, when St. Paul talks about unequally yoked, he's talking about a believer and a non-believer. And that's exactly what this situation is. To the extent that your son is a believer anymore, and I hope he is, I hope he's telling you the truth when he says that he is, then if we say he's a believer, he's a baptized Christian, a follower of Jesus after a fashion anyway, well, he is unequally yoked because although this woman may be wonderful in every respect, she may be beautiful and vivacious and the most wonderful woman walking the face of the earth, they're unequally yoked because she doesn't believe in Jesus. And so they don't share this most fundamental of ingredients for, if you ask me, for a happy marriage. And that is that they both are looking at reality the same way. They both are looking at God and to God the same way. You're both, you, the husband and she, the wife, would be having God at the center of your marriage. You can't really do that in the case of a mixed marriage, mixed with a Christian and a non-Christian. And this is in no way intended to suggest anything negative in any personal way about the non-Christian person. As I say, she may be a wonderful woman, but he's setting himself up for one of two things, if you ask me. One would be his eventual departure from his belief in Jesus. Or he's setting himself up for a lifetime of friction. If he really is serious about Jesus, if he really is serious about living his life this way and marrying a woman who will see the world the way he does, see God the way he does, he's inevitably going to have a difficult time. Sometimes these are impossible situations. Now, I know there are people, maybe you're one of them, and you're writing me, not you, Kathleen, but there are people who are instantaneously going to say, but Patrick, I married a Jew, or I married an atheist, or I married, you know, fill in the blank, and everything worked out great, and my husband wound up becoming Catholic. That's great. I'm really happy for you, and I mean that sincerely. I'm really happy for you, but that's outside the norm. Your experience, if that's what you went through, and you married a non-believer, or you married a non-Catholic, say a Protestant or something, and everything came up roses some years later, and it all worked out, that's great, but that's not normal. That's not typical. In fact, the church released a document some years ago. It's called Matrimonia Mixta. It was under the pontificate, if I remember correctly, of Pope Paul VI. I believe it was released in the 1970s. Matrimonia Mixta, M-I-X-T-A. And that is a document that spells out the church's, I don't know if you could say frowning upon, disapproval of, strongly recommending against, whatever word you want to choose, mixed marriages. And it's not because looking down on anybody, it's not saying Catholics are better than other people or anything like that. It's just saying the church's 2,000-year wisdom drawn upon or drawn from experience is that more often than not, a mixed marriage is very difficult in this area. Success stories notwithstanding. So my advice would be, I would encourage you to lovingly continue to try to offer him some advice. He may or may not be willing to hear it. I understand how these things are. You can only do what you can do. And you're right about the trip to Mexico. Obviously, if they're going to Mexico together, they're probably going to be in the same hotel room together. And if they're in the same hotel room together, then you and I both know what's going to happen. So I completely understand why you as his mom are making this a point of advice to him. And if he's not going to listen to it, well, then I think the best thing you can do right now is turn this over to our Lord. This is an opportunity to trust him more. You worked really hard, you and her husband, to raise him in the faith, and now rely upon God's grace and mercy and ask him every day. I'm sure you're already doing it, but I just want to encourage you, continue asking the Lord to bless your son and to bring him home to a full practice of his Catholic faith. And also invoke the intercession of Saint Monica, the mother of Saint Augustine, because her story with her son was very much the same with you. He was shacked up with a girl for a long time, fathered a child out of wedlock. In fact, in many ways, he was more down that road than it sounds like your son is. And St. Monica's prayers eventually paid off. And he came back, and he became one of the greatest saints the Catholic Church has ever known. So there's hope for anybody. Well, I think with that, we are probably at the end of our time. So we're going to take another break and come back with hour two. More of your emails coming up, and they just keep coming in. Cyrus, in the time that we were doing this first hour of the program today, about another 7 emails rolled in. So as you can see, we've got a lot of work to do. But we'll continue at it on the other side of this quick timeout. Please stay right there.